Welcome to another episode of Innovation ODC. Today I have with me from a different part of the world, Nick McEverly. He is a founder and a fractional product leader. Welcome, Nick. How are you?
Hey, Renu. Happy to be here. Great. I have a newborn at home and I've actually gotten some sleep last night, so I can't complain about anything.
Oh, those are two good things. Newborn and sleep. That's independently good. Together, even better.
Agreed.
And where are you now?
I'm in Mexico City right now, but I'm originally from New York and lived in Chicago for about a decade before this.
Very, very different places, huh?
Yes.
I always give my guests the opportunity to pitch themselves for 30 seconds. Who are you and what do you do?
So I'm a founder, and my story is heavily influenced by my background in design. I studied a really cool program at Cornell University called Human-Centered Design that examined humans and design through the lens of product, interiors, buildings. And then in grad school, I started my first company and got exposed to digital product design as well, UX, UI. And that's where I feel like I really learned all the ingredients that were necessary to start a company. And I've been kind of doing it ever since.
So the companies, I'm going to assume there is not one, there are multiple companies?
There have been multiple companies and will continue to be multiple companies, luckily. I learned after starting my second or third company that design is just obviously very critical. The standards that are kind of publicly expected these days, everyone expects good design in a product. Whereas 10 years ago, I think you had more leeway. And I became, especially in the last 5 or 6 years, I became really obsessed with the idea of testing new ideas, because I find that good ideas are not in short supply. It's choosing the right idea that's difficult. And so I became and spent the last, 8-10 years testing ideas and getting really good at doing that quickly and cheaply. And so that's what I'm hoping to share today is a couple of pieces of advice and tactics that I've used to test business ideas in different verticals and now in different countries.
So can you walk me through your startups?
Sure. It's kind of a long road, so I'll try to make it brief. My first company was in urban agriculture. I hoped to build greenhouses on rooftops that would feed the buildings below. Mm-hmm. Raised some friends and family, learned a lot, moved on to a couple of other companies that I started with two gentlemen, a marketer and a tech developer. And it was there that I pivoted 4 times with those partners and I got really good at the pivot. Mm-hmm. And that's where I became obsessed with this idea that pivoting and product market fit is probably the most valuable skill that a founder could have. And after that company found some fit and began to scale, I realized that I really preferred that 0-1 moment and started an agency called Further Faster with 2 other partners, where we would help other startups build their companies and test their ideas. And so I did that for another 4 or 5 years and left that company about a year ago, sold my stake to my partner, and have been back in the founder's seat, building a couple of companies myself and doing some consulting as well on the side.
The company where you did the pivot 4 times.
It took about a year per pivot, maybe a little bit less. And we went from an app builder, kind of like a Squarespace for apps, that we kind of sold for scraps to a small venue ticket arm of Ticketmaster, and then moved to a single media app that combined a bunch of different APIs, content APIs, video, audio, written media, and then moved from that to a single type of media, just audio, and then from that audio platform to a kind of incentivized listening platform that's currently called Mode, and that has millions of users and 7 or 8 figures of annual revenue now, and was named the number 2 fastest growing software company in North America last year. I've been lucky to have a lot of
points. Is that what you're proud of the most?
And growth and accolades like that are helpful for podcasts, I suppose. But it was really the experiences that I had with my co-founders that I'm most proud of, and leading the team. We had a fairly small team during my time there, anywhere between 10 and 20, 25 folks. And I really enjoyed the murky parts of that business. During those pivots, we had to let go of some people and then rehire some folks. And I think I'm happiest when I'm having difficult conversations. And so that's been a mainstay for my career. It's kind of a marker now. If I haven't had a hard conversation in 6 months, I don't think I'm moving fast enough. So I think I'm most proud of the hard conversations that I've had with my partners, my co-founders, as well as employees and teammates, and potential partners as well. Those are the things that felt like they moved the needle for me in terms of my career.
I have not heard that from a person in a long time.
Yeah. Who was the last person you heard it from?
I think that was me.
Oh, well, tell me, why is it that you like difficult conversations then?
I think that difficult conversations are necessary because they make you decide. To have a difficult conversation, you need to know why you're having the conversation and what you're going to do after the conversation. Whenever I always want to find those people who we are able to have that conversation with, because that's how you grow.
Amen. I think it's like a precursor or a qualifier for me in business relationships, especially, obviously personal relationships as well. But you're forced to have conversations that are difficult more in professional circumstances. So I've been really fortunate to have partners throughout my career that I've chosen or have chosen me, and have had just the most open, vulnerable, loving, scary conversations with. And I think that's what I'm most proud of. You know, I'm still close with all the people I've built businesses with, and anyone who's built a business knows that that's actually really difficult. And so I really, that's a point of pride for me outside of the user numbers and revenue numbers from companies I've built.
And maybe this is me searching for something that's not there. Are there any gender differences or differences by country of origin?
I haven't noticed any. I've had 3 male partners and 1 female partner, and I love them all equally. I would say, though, that my female partner, Ellie Barmacel, is probably the most skilled communicator I've ever met. And that was something I noticed immediately about her. And it made me feel a sense of security. It made me feel like we could talk about anything. And I know that we're going to have difficult conversations ahead of us. And so I've taken great comfort in that. And we're still scheming and coming, cooking up ideas and deals together today.
Okay, that's good. I always had faith in that kind of humanity, but you've kind of reestablished my faith in the ability to have difficult discussions and decisions, and then to still continue to work with them. I also think that you probably attract those kind of people more than you think, and probably that is, you know, that the ability to those people with whom you can have the conversations, you attract that.
Thanks. Yeah, I haven't thought of it that way. It's certainly something that I look for and search for.
Okay. Now a little bit to what you are doing in Mexico City. What are you doing?
I've been tinkering with a couple of things. I tried to start a jewelry company while I was here. A good friend of mine, designer Max Davis, made these beautiful 3D printed pendants that are personalized, come in precious metals, and ran into a couple of issues with supply chain. I spent about $5,000 on like influencer marketing and social media marketing, and no one bought a single pendant. And so I knew then that that was not worth my time and I should move on to the next thing. Still holds a place in my heart, of course. I learned a little bit about social media marketing and influencer marketing along the way, which is super valuable. Then I started a mezcal tasting room here, partnered with a social club named Yayem, and host a tasting for mostly foreigners traveling through Mexico City who want to get to know the culture here. And I think Mexico is a complex country, and mezcal, for some reason, is a spirit similar to tequila. Tequila is a form of mezcal. I just want to clarify for anyone who's an aficionado. It's a microcosm of the country. And so I used it kind of as a mechanism or a method to get to know the country better. And I was super blessed to visit palenques and farms out in the countryside, and also meet and make some friends in the nightlife scene here in Mexico City. So it served its purpose for me as a hobby, and I was able to set it up as a business to kind of set run on its own now. So that's kind of operating in the background, and I'm just starting another CPG company here that I can't talk too much about, but a passion project as well. It's focused on social good and impact through the lens of CPG and kind of capitalism. But I think that there's room for conscious capitalism everywhere. I think that's a very American attitude, potentially, being an addict of capitalism personally. I'm excited to see the results and get the product out into the world. It should be next month, actually. So I'll keep you posted.
That would be fabulous. Are any of these, the jewelry one and the mezcal one are not products, right? Tech product. They are not. They don't come under that category.
No, and none of the projects I'm starting this year are really technology-based. Certainly use technology to test them and to determine if there's a market. But no, they're outside of computers. And that was intentional on my part because I really wanted to get out from behind my desk a little bit more and interact with people more than I was.
Okay. I mean, my next question was like, do you miss that?
I don't. I've spent a decade in software more and still, you know, the other half of my week is spent talking to customers of technology companies because that's my consulting practice. I'll interview customers, 6 to 10 customers per platform per month, and then synthesize that data into insights that affect and drive strategy in the sales departments, marketing strategies, product design. And that's what I love to do, I think. And although I want to get out from behind my desk, that part of the work has kept me there and has always made me really satisfied, luckily.
Okay. I also took a look at your website and I liked how the way you positioned yourself. I like it because most entrepreneurs are so multifaceted and people who try to put us in a box, they don't understand how entrepreneurs work. But that's the world, right? We are a small percentage and everyone else is there. And so you have to speak to the larger percentage. And so how would you, we had your introduction as a leader and a fractional product leader, owner. How is that still your core? Like if I was sitting next to you at a bar and I said, hey, who are you? Is that what you're still going to tell me?
I suppose I wouldn't tell you what's on my website if we're sitting together at a bar. I try to make it a little bit more interesting. I think, you know, in a sentence, I would summarize to another entrepreneur that I really love to test new ideas. And that's my skill set, is to test a new concept before you bring it to market to see if it's worth investing in.
And when someone puts an idea in front of you, do you have these automatic green/red flags or are you open?
Usually very open because I don't want to assume that I know the market or the customer. So I always start with questions. Asking good questions is the foundation of any good research program and discovery process. And so I would probably spend a good amount of time thinking about the questions I would ask of those customers and would obviously do a little bit of competitive analysis and some research on the market landscape. Those are the two places I start.
And then once you kind of at least conceptually feel that there is a product market fit, do you lose interest?
No, it's quite the opposite. If there's interest from the market and I know that I have the stamina to start the company personally, then I would move forward, of course. And that's something I have to gauge with the other founders that I work with is, you know, do you care about this problem? Is this thing going to keep you up at night and keep you going for months or years on end? I find entrepreneurs can somewhat be opportunistic and find a solution that they can sell, but not fall in love with the problem. And the problem sometimes changes and therefore the solution changes. So their motivation can dwindle over time if you just fall in love with the solution. So my advice is to always fall in love with the problem first and a person, type of person first, and chase those two things. And as long as you're constantly staying in contact and understanding that person, understanding their problem, you'll always find a place to go with a business strategy.
Your background in human-centric design, is that something that you put to work in all the things that you've done?
Yes, every day you can put the center and should put the human at the center of everything. Whether I'm making a fundraising deck or I'm designing a marketing campaign, I'm putting the investor or the customer at the center of that exercise. So if it's a fundraising deck, I'm thinking about who is this investor? How many multiples of return do they need? Are they on their first fund or fifth fund? What's the hypothesis or thesis for the fund that they're raising? Do I even need investor money? Can I do this through private credit or debt or some other facility? And almost doing a persona that we would normally reserve for a customer on the investor. And right, use more traditional tactics for customer stuff using personas, understand their demography and psychography to use their attitudes and behaviors to my advantage usually, but also to understand them, paint an accurate picture of what they need and how big their pain is, and do they feel it frequently enough for them to pay me to help solve this problem. So human-centered design is at the center of everything I do, luckily, and I hope through podcasts like these, I can make the case that they should be at the center of everything all entrepreneurs do, because that's ultimately what we're doing at the end of the day, is solving problems.
I mean, if you don't have a good team, you have nothing, right? Well, I guess on that note of human-centered design, what do you think about colors?
Tell me more. What do you mean by that question?
Okay, a little bit of a background. I was doing a deck with my co-founder for a VC fund that I'm raising, and I noticed some different colors, and I sent it to him. He's like, I'm blind. I don't understand what color you want. He's a man, and he says women and men see color differently. And I went crazy because I was like, no, this is the maroon you have to put. Maybe it's because I'm a woman that I'm very, I don't know. A lot of the UI UX designers are women. And they really pick on the small things, the small color, the gradations that you should use, what each means. And I don't know whether it's just personality or gender. Is there a module on color?
Yes. Color psychology is real. I try not to get too caught up in it because I find that it's often discredited the rest of the narrative around human-centered design. Things like color and maybe shape are more akin to art or style, you know, something like taste. But when I talk about human-centered design, I talk about like psychology and the order of events and how someone is caused to feel at a certain point in their journey. And so it's much more like overarching. And when we talk about things like color or shape, button size, etc., they distract from the more serious components in the conversation. So it's a habit of mine to avoid those kinds of discussions because I worry about their impact on the rest of the perceived value of human-centered design. They seem arbitrary to most people. And I think that they're important, and there's theory, you know, color theory and all this other stuff around it, which I think we should take into account, but I don't like to spend too much time on it. That's just me personally.
Has there been any major evolutions in human-centric design since the time you went to uni and now?
I think, like I was saying before, I think the standards have increased. Everything from our electronics to the cars we drive to the buildings we're inhabiting, and this is what I study the overlap between all of these things, has become really intentional, right? Everything from the sound a door makes when you close it on a car, that's been studied and optimized by, you know, the sound of the engine when it turns on. Like there's all of these things that ignite our senses that are very small and nuanced that a ton of attention have been brought to. And so when you think about software or even CPG, the details really matter these days. So if you look at like beer companies, for instance, or largely in the CPG vertical, there was a boom in, let's say, 2000s, 2010s around craft and craftsmanship and small batch and all of this. And that was valued. And that had a differentiator for a lot of independent brands. They would feature that as something. But then larger companies, right, people with millions of customers or more, started to hijack those aesthetics. And so craft became kind of vanilla and ubiquitous and it kind of lost its meaning. And so you have to keep up with these trends and understand what the significance of them is. And I think that that's an important thing for us to take into account as we understand the impact of design on consumption and marketability and merchandising. It's critical for us to start in a place of, that makes sense, not just follow the trend. And I think that that's that's the way to stay ahead of changes in design and aesthetics. I would also say that there's more executive level design leadership now. There have been a few companies that have really led the way in terms of design. Brian Chesky from Airbnb comes to mind. Scott Belsky from Behance, who's now the VP of product at Adobe. These leaders are creating a narrative around design at the highest level. And so design is no longer a thing that's saved for the end. It's part of the architecture. And I'm really proud of that change, and I'm excited to see how that will continue.
How different is building a business in Mexico City than it's in New York and Chicago?
Couple of ways. It's harder to get private capital here. So loans and banks charge really high interest and will put up a lot of barriers to getting access to that. In the United States, very small business friendly in the United States. I'm very grateful for that. Regulations are a little bit higher in the United States than they are here for a couple of different reasons. There's the legal structure, like we have tort cases in the United States, just like kind of small claims issues. And then that's not really that popular here in Mexico. So there's a less insurance mandate because there's less of an issue around getting sued or having legal liability, which allows you to innovate a little bit faster, get things out onto the market with less red tape, which has been great. The middle class in Mexico is growing considerably, but in the United States has been a mainstay for the last 100 years. So I'm excited to see. I think Mexico is going through a really big change socioeconomically, that will lead to more access to credit and more entrepreneurship, I think. But there's also just a difference in the way of thinking. I think the United States is really leads the culture in terms of innovation and being able to speak up and suggest new ideas to leadership. And if you're, you know, that type of culture is smiled upon. It's not always consistent, I think, in the United States, but it's something that a lot of companies strive to uphold is, you know, bring a good idea to the table. Let's find, you know, solutions through committee and things. And I find that's a little bit less so here in Mexico, for one reason or another. And I'm excited to build some companies that help challenge that state of mind and hopefully bring about a little bit more innovation here. But there's a lot of headwinds in terms of politics, interests. Like there's a lot of private interests that will act to keep your product from going to market if it affects them. And that's less so in the United States. Slightly because there's so much going on, it would be difficult to keep an eye out for these types of threat vectors. But the network is really here in a particular vertical. So like everybody in the mezcal world, for instance, knows everybody. And when I tried, you know, I'm being a white guy from the United States starting mezcal, which is a spiritual elixir here, I definitely was met with a lot of hate and doubt and surprise. And a lot of it was motivated out of respect. It was not a profit-focused endeavor at all. And as I move forward, I think into other verticals, I'm going to be keeping a lookout for that type of resistance and need good partners, a resilient, you know, backbone, I think, to keep going through and keep ignoring the naysayers when it's appropriate. That being said, being a foreigner, trying to start a business in a country that has a lot of really bad experiences with foreign intervention, I need to be really sensitive to that and considerate and empathetic to how I'm framing my business goals, who I'm speaking with, how I'm partnering with people, and make sure I'm putting the community and the country and the people at the center of all of this, which is what I do. So I'm excited to be able to do that in a country that's not my own. It'll be challenging for sure.
Well, I wish you luck with that. I know how hard it is, and it takes time. Because people have to understand that you're almost here for them as much as you're there for you. and it just takes time.
You know, one of the companies I'm starting, the CPG company I'm starting now, my lawyer was like, I don't really feel comfortable with the way you're going about this. Like, this kind of is going against the ethics of our firm. And I was like, holy shit, that's quite, you know, that should I be worried? And so we had an honest conversation, totally respect him setting boundaries. And this is not the first time that's happened to me. So it's really important for me to like listen intently, try to read what the issue is, push, I think it's one of my strengths is to push beyond where, you know, the point where someone might stop and see what happens. I'm the son of two lawyers. And so the idea of breaking terms and conditions or doing something that would, you know, put me in some sort of legal hot water, I would stay away from in the past. But my, you know, past co-founders and partners have taught me that a little bit of risk is necessary, because if you stay within the lines all the time, they will never change, and the envelope will never be pushed. And so I think that's one of our jobs as entrepreneurs, is to challenge the status quo, and in a place as traditional as Mexico, that can be really difficult and be met with a lot of friction and doubt.
Do you consider yourself to be an entrepreneur or an innovator?
How do you distinguish between those two? I think that there's a marriage somehow. It feels like a riddle.
The definition is up to you. I ask this to everyone. It's up to you to determine.
Maybe I have a prejudice against the French language, but I hate the word entrepreneur.
Why is that? Oh, you have to tell me that.
I really don't know. I just, if it sounds so snooty, it sounds so, I'm better than you, you know? And I think that really entrepreneurs, the true entrepreneurs, the true leaders, the CEOs, et cetera, that are starting businesses and building them, are working for their employees, are working for their customers, if you're doing this right. And the word entrepreneur sounds like a high echelon of society that just makes a lot of money and doesn't care about anyone else. And I think that that's really, I might be projecting. I was like, I don't think this is actually, it's not based in any real fact, but that's just my perception of it all. So I prefer founder, I guess, because it sounds like it's down at the bottom. You're at the base. You're creating a foundation for other people to stand on. And I think that's a beautiful thing. But you can't have one without innovation. You have to be innovating. You have to be, you know, changing something, because that's where opportunity lies. And there's no risk that's worth taking without changing the status quo.
How impactful, if at all, is AI going to be on the things that you are currently doing now?
Very impactful. A lot of what I do is pattern recognition in the market at large and within a specific customer segment. And so AI is really well attuned to pattern recognition, whether it's synthesizing the interviews or survey results to find the most common phrase, term, sentiment, or it's identifying more of a longitudinal trend over, you know, let's say a specific. There's something I've been reading about. I don't know if you've seen this one recently, but it's called the forgetting curve. But it's like the amount of time it takes for someone to forget about a technology or for it to not be interesting to them anymore. And I witnessed this with cryptocurrency and blockchain technology now twice. And the same for AI, I think, is going to happen in the next year or two. But the fact that it is iterating so quickly and growing so quickly, it might be able to beat that curve. I'd say AI is helping mainly through pattern recognition and longitudinal pattern recognition. Like, if, let's say, if you can apply, and there's also something called the hype curve. I've used it, the Gartner hype cycle. It's very similar in its sentiment to the forgetting curve. I don't know if I'm using the right word there, but I think that that's the general idea. That there's a repeating cycle that is limited by the human psyche, our ability to take in new information, hold it for a long time, share that information with others from a social standpoint. And I'm really fascinated about how an AI can look at these curves and compare them across time. So something that happened 100 years ago in a world that is so different than the one we have today can mirror and predict behavior that's happening today or in the next couple of years, if we're using the right vectors and kind of creating the model in an intelligent way. And so I'm excited about the potential there. I use it a lot for competitive analysis. I can do a competitive analysis in a day or two, where it used to take me a week or two. And excited to see where things will go even beyond this. Like, from a design perspective strictly, you can make a website a lot faster, write copy for a website a lot faster. You can generate images a lot faster. You can create content for your blog a lot faster. So everything is just being sped up. I don't think that the quality is being maintained in the process, but for those starting a new idea or just building a business from scratch, quality can be sacrificed early on. And so I think AI will lead generally to a lot more, I hesitate to say innovation, but more businesses being started.
That's a very positive outlook as compared to some of the regular doom and gloom that you read everywhere.
Yeah, it's here for us. The people who are most scared of it taking their jobs or their roles are the ones who should be spending the most time understanding it.
Wrapping up on that note, what is the outlook for entrepreneurs like, sorry, founders like you, who have done a lot of things and then decide they want to, you know, transport themselves to a completely different environment and then take on those challenges and build better, sustainable things? What is your personal outlook for that?
Oh, it looks great. Countries like India are just growing so fast in the entrepreneurial scene. I've been keeping tabs. Latin America as well. I think the VC model is actually kind of shrinking in the United States, and the attention and opportunity is growing in so much of the rest of the world. I think a lot of it is dependent on the social culture of that space and of those places. I think Mexico City and Bogota, Colombia, are poised to be the capitals of Latin American technology. And I'm very excited about Latin America specifically because it's in such close proximity to the United States, and we have a real relationship between the two countries that is growing and becoming even more close and interdependent. And I hope along the way, the US will take a couple of pages from Mexico's book too, because the lifestyle and the culture in Mexico is so much more vibrant and expressive than the United States. I cannot wait to see what comes from all Latin America, not just Mexico.
Thank you very much for your time, Nick. It was great. I always enjoy my podcast episodes.
Yeah, you're a lucky person to have not only this audience, but some really interesting people to talk to.
Thank you.